गुरवे गौरचंद्राय राधिकाय तदालय कृष्णाय कृष्ण भक्ताय तद्भक्ताय नमो नमः। सो प्रणाम टू इच वन ऑफ यू फ्रॉम लुगानो। इट्स एन एरिया हियर इन स्विट्जरलैंड, एज यू कैन सी। This is a real background, as I was telling some of you. Till rain doesn't come, I'll be here. We'll see. I'm spending a few more last days in this solitary retreat in the Alps. Very calm, very beautiful, very soothing, very inducing for contemplation and prayer and writing. That's generally a writing spot for me, where I have started or concluded writing a few of my books. And this case has not been an exception to that rule. Not planned, but that's how it happens. And yeah, we have an interesting week with also many beautiful celebrations in our Vaishnav calendar, right? We had the disappearance day of Sri Gadadhar Pandit Bhaktivinoda Thakur a few days ago. Then we have Gundicha March and Leela, this beautiful cleansing of the temple of the heart, ultimately, to prepare the ground for the sweet absolute to fully be installed in the core of our being. Though he already is, they already are, but there has to be some willingness on our part to give the welcome officially. And what else? And then came Ratha Yatra, the festival of chariots, a very beautiful celebration that actually for Gaudiya Vaishnava symbolized something so very deep, very touching connection to how God is dragged down from the throne into the realm of intimacy, to the realm of one-on-one. Jagannath is brought down from the altar, from the notion of being God, and by the force of the love, the Vrajavasis, he's dragged back to Vrindavan, to relate in full intimacy, losing full awareness that he's God, basically. So that's a very unique peculiarity, a very charming one, I will say. At least for me, from the Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition. From the Vaishnava tradition, many Vaishnava traditions who emphasize this Vrindavan conception, where love bewilders the divine. And everyone is bewildering in the context of that, losing sight who is who and just seeing each other in terms of love. So here we are from Shyam Priya Kunj, sending my pranam to each one of you. And as usual, you are more than invited if you have any questions, any topics, any explorations you may like to bring to the table today. More than welcome. I'm doing the hosting today, and I will be coordinating recording what's and the breakout rooms since Bhaktarasa doesn't have enough good connection in Milan, Italy. So we'll start. There are already four raised hands. If there is anything else, feel free to raise your digital hand. If not, we have enough meal on the table. And the first raised hand came from Rome, Italy, from Greta Fabrizi or Gayatri.
Do you
I can, welcome.
hear me? Okay, thank you so much. Well, I have written the question because, as you know, the last time I realized I had to sharpen it a little bit. So, in order not to lose myself while speaking, I've written everything.
Okay.
So the question is this. Well, in order to be more and more aligned with reality, I think we have to feel God's love, work upon humanity, and perceive everything as sacred. Maybe many people do not resonate with these points, and some of us went into this paragraph in this lifetime or in former lives. Even if mercy is always coming, and even if we have had countless teachings and experiences, we didn't got aware of our inner desire of unconditional love for a long, long time. Maybe it is too personal to answer, but are there some shared dynamics in ourselves that bring our free will to shift from self-centeredness to authentic and eternal and fulfilling path of love.
To be honest, Gayatri, I had difficulty following the question.
Okay.
Do you have the whole thing written down in digital way? Because maybe
Yes. Yeah.
you can send it in the chat and I can read it. Because also the audio was not the best here, so I don't know if
Okay.
it's my connection on yours. So I can, maybe you can send it publicly or through a private message, and I can read it quickly. So I can really respond to the actual question and not to whatever I may have understood.
Here it is.
Okay, in order to be more and more aligned with reality, I think we have to feel less love work upon to perceive. Okay, thank you. So you're wondering if maybe it is too personal. Well, it's always too personal because we want to be radical personalists. So it never is too personal. It's as personal as it can get, the question, and it's beautiful. So yeah, as you mentioned in the beginning of the question, it's important to work on our humanity. It's important, and we are invited, not only in our tradition, but in other sister traditions, to see reality as sacred, to perceive gradually the presence of the sacred with capital S everywhere, basically. It sounds easy, but it's a gradual process, a gradual awakening and restoration of vision. And of course, in the beginning, I wouldn't say people may not resonate, though someone may say I do not resonate, but I would say maybe some people have difficulty having such a broad idea. It may sound too broad for them. It may be too much, like God is everywhere, everything is sacred. They may need some initial delineation between sacred and non-sacred. Again, from the broader perspective, everything is sacred. But in the beginning, we need some boundaries, so to say, some notions of what it is this, what it is that, because if we don't have the vision, it may be difficult for us to walk on that vision. But at one point, yeah, it becomes necessary to to shift from this black and white binary to realize at the end of the day, God is everywhere, sacredness is everywhere, and it is up to me to attune to that reality, and that becomes now my sadhana. Now becomes now the invitation I'm receiving to embrace in my practice. Right? Maybe before the practice was about avoiding the impure and staying with the sacred, and eventually you realize everything is sacred or have a glimpse of that, and then now your practice becomes how to actualize that vision, how to remain in that way of seeing constantly, or how to be coherent with that vision in action, in relationship. So yeah, we have all gone through these chapters, some of us more in one, some of us in others. Each one is in their own journey, irrepeatable. So of course, this is not to judge anything or anyone. Hopefully we can appreciate and understand the need for each one of these chapters for everyone. The important thing is that we do not deceive ourselves trying to live a chapter that we are not ready for yet, or that we are ready to abandon already now, right? So that's the main thing, not so much in which chapter are you, but remain in the chapter that corresponds to your current chapter of the journey. So going to the question itself, okay, mercy is always coming. Yeah, for a long time we may have not been aware of the need for unconditional love, at least overtly, though that's ultimately the thing that we are thirsty for and looking for, though again, by ignorance, if we want to use a word we misdiagnosed the landscape, and we concluded that we needed so many other things apart from unconditional love. Probably we needed everything but unconditional, or we looked for love, but not understanding that the love we need to give and to receive ultimately is of an unconditional nature. So sometimes we misdiagnose love for very conditional love, and we're not fulfilled with that, and try it again, and try here and try there with this, with that, till gradually, hopefully, we come to realize the closer we get to the principle of unconditional love, the more we find ourselves fulfilled, like the Bhagavatam says, right? Sabai pumsam parodharmo yato bhakti radokshaya. Hai tu ki apratihata jayatma suprasidati. Hai tu ki apratihata jayatma suprasidati. That which gives complete fulfillment to the self is that bhakti, which is hai tu ki and apratihata, which is by itself, for itself. It's unconditional. Another way of putting that. So when we connect with unconditional bhakti, love, jayatma samprasidati, the self experiences total satisfaction. So that's in the Bhagavatam, right? So in that connection, the question is, well, are there some shared dynamics in ourselves that bring our free will to shift from self-centeredness to unauthentic, eternal, and fulfilling path of love? Well, yes, of course, if there wouldn't be that, there is no hope. So, and I will say, beyond whatever I may say, I hope all of us have had some glimpse of unconditional love, some hint of that, some appetizer of that. So if we had, and if you didn't have, no, don't feel guilty about it, but if any of us have, just go turn to that situation. No? What happened there? What touched that in you? What created a shift? And that may be the beginning of the answer, because it's not that it's just one unique formula that helps everyone to turn to this from self-centeredness to unconditional love. Each one is unique. But as I like to think, as I like to say, okay, I'm just paying attention because some drops of rain may be coming. So at any moment you may see me shifting to another room, to a room actually. So, okay, I'm waiting a few more drops till I start to see the electronic devices collapsing. Okay. Yeah, I'll have to move. One minute. Bear with me. So, we've lost absolutely all the momentum. I may need to basically go back to what I had to say, but anyhow, life happens, weather happens. I wanted just to give you darshan of the beautiful space here. Last week, I remember I had to do it inside because it was already cloudy, and it seems I didn't learn my lesson and was a little bit stubborn with showing the landscape. So how to move from self-centeredness basically to a fulfilling path of love? I mean, in one sense, your question is another way of asking what we are doing here on a daily basis as bhaktas. You know? That will be a way of framing what we are trying to do on a daily basis in our practice, basically, is how to turn from self-centeredness to love-centeredness. You know? I mean, and I think it's a very important way of learning to conceive our practice in that way, because again, many times we may say, "Oh, what do you do? What's your practice?" "Oh, I follow these rules. I do this. I do not do that." That's it. And it's actually no. I'm trying to reorient, recalibrate my cosmic vision from a self-centered one to a universal one. And it's a gradual process. Again, it's not necessarily that that it happens all within one moment, as we were talking the other day, and it still is very applicable, because we were talking, I remember, La Berna, about this notion of the World Cup that is going on in terms of soccer, when people somehow feel very elated, very ecstatic, you could say, on some degree, of course. I'm not comparing this with what Mahapra was experiencing, but they feel that they enlarge their sense of self is enlarged by experiencing that they belong to something bigger than themselves, because they belong to a country, no? In a football match, or sometimes to people it may happen in a war, unfortunately. Football match is its own little world, because it's still one against the other. You need to defeat the other for you to win. So still someone is a loser. But my point is, you leave the bubble of self-centeredness and the bubble of isolation and the bubble where you are the only absolute point of reference in your mind. I mean, I'm talking to you, Gayatri, in our mind. And we now can feel more spaciousness. Oh, I belong to something bigger than myself. I belong to this country, or I belong to this neighborhood, and I belong to this human race, and I belong to the planet Earth. So you can see different layers of expansiveness in how we see ourselves, and how can we see ourselves in relationship to something bigger that gets bigger and bigger. And that's the ideal way to live self-centeredness, right? To have genuine experiences when you can see, as simple as that sounds, we can have a direct experience that I'm not the center of the universe. And because we go back to that place many times per day in general. Of course, we are not thinking in that way. We are not thinking I am the center of the universe, but we behave as such. We react as such many times. We feel as such. And I'm not saying that is from a place of evil. It's actually a situation very much worthy of our compassion, because the moment you put yourself as the absolute point of reference for everything, that's such an impossible burden. Self-centeredness is an impossibility. No, I think it's important to, maybe it all starts with some understanding, theoretical understanding, that actually it's not that you are the center of the universe and you have to move from the center. Nobody can be ever the center of the universe. There's already a center. That seat is already occupied from eternity. So it's an impossibility to be the center. So self-centeredness is not possible, actually. It's not possible in actuality. So it's just a fantasy. It's a forced hallucination. So sometimes we need to speak in those terms to realize, oh, well, to start to dismantle, dissect the situation that be very grossly identified with. Because it may be our only point of reference. It may be the only sense of identity I was able to develop so far, for whatever reason. Again, not but for in order to make anyone feel bad. It's just like proper diagnosis. So sometimes we need first to decenter our false sense of self-centeredness and try to show and to hear and to understand how actually I'm not the center, and that's such a huge relief. It's not a problem, because so far, many times we feel as long as I'm in control of the situation, things will go right, which is another way of saying, as long as I'm in the center, things will go right. So, and that's exactly the other way around, because first of all, you are not in the center, you cannot be in the center. And the more you try to be in the center, things will go worse and worse. So it's very important for us to really understand how we are not the center, and how the center is the center of beauty, harmony, and love. And that's why we need to be repeatedly exposed sometimes to these narratives, so gradually we can become convinced and counteract, who knows for how long, narratives that go in the other direction, that keep sounding all day, all along, because that's the illusion that many times society in general, I want to say, not everyone, of course, but wants to feed us, the media or stuff like that. You are the center. No, everything revolves around you. No, and we are not. And I'm not saying that in a way that is self-erasure or self-rejection. It's just about, I mean, the best thing you can do for yourself is to acknowledge your place in the world, to acknowledge who you are. So self-centeredness is an act of violence because it's a stubborn insistence of being who you will never be able to be. So that's basically putting yourself in the torture chamber. So that's not very nice. So it's an act of compassion and self-love and self-acceptance to accept who am I and to realize how much that it already is. So for me, that's on one side, some people that may be the most helpful thing for some to hear the things gradually, deconstruct the false narrative. For others, it may start again with glimpses like the one I gave, which is a material example. Okay, I belong to something bigger to myself, to this country, to this race, to this group. So you get a higher taste beyond the bubble of self-centeredness. So maybe that hint will help for you to play out the implications of that and realize, oh, the bigger this gets, the better I feel. The bigger is the circle of belonging, the more fulfilled I am. So and maybe you at one point we start to wonder, is it possible that there is a circle of belonging that includes everyone? No, where there doesn't need to be another, us and them. It's only us. No? That's basically what we are trying to attain in life and in our practice, to reach that circle of belonging. I mean, that circle of belonging already exists. As Father Richard Rohr will say, everything belongs. No? Already that's happening. The point is that we are not aware of that. So again, from self-centeredness, we behave in ways that do not affirm this belonging, but everything already belongs. There's not us and them ontologically. It's just a psychological delusion we are going through. So practice is about awakening to that. And sometimes that starts by gradual, sustainable exposures to small increments in belonging. No? For some people, again, that can be being part of, I can recall in my own time, when I was a teenager and I went to some of my first concerts, somehow I felt part of the tribe of people in the concert. It felt like we were all there for the same purpose. Again, it was not transcendent, it was not universal, but it was bigger than a more narrow and suffocating version I had of myself. I was exposed to something that, oh, I found peers. Oh. Now I belong to a tribe, to a family. Satsanga is all about that. Enlarging your sense of self by realizing, oh, I belong. I'm not alone. I'm not the center. Again, that displaces this illusory self-centeredness even without thinking about it. It's not that sometimes we need to think too much about it. Sometimes we just need to be exposed to an experience that is so powerful that self-centeredness has been just swept away by a stronger current. Or again, even like exposing to the miracles of nature. Like I'm now here contemplating the beautiful Swiss Alps, and that naturally creates in me the notion that I am not the center of the universe. Now that's a very helpful landscape to realize I'm not the center. I'm part of something bigger. Or like when you are looking at the ocean. What to speak when we are having genuine, profound spiritual, mystical experiences through prayer. I mean, so whatever works better for us, but it's healthy that we make some conscious effort to put ourselves in places and situations and relationships where we will be naturally shown that not so much you are not the center, but more like you belong to something bigger to yourself, no? From more positive content. But yeah, that's basically what we are all trying to do. on a daily basis, hopefully as bhaktas, as human beings, as spiritual beings, practitioners, sadhakas, however you like to call it, we are trying to gradually shift from self-centeredness to love-centeredness. It's a gradual shift. Again, it's not one act performance. It doesn't generally happen in a weekend, in a year, in a decade, but I think it's an ongoing question for all of us to ask how to be decentralized, basically, in that sense. And of course, as I say, for me personally, apart from the things I said, especially emphasizing Sadhu Sangha, and that's not limited, of course, to Gaudiya Vaishnava members, that's Sadhu Sangha, but just exposed to relationships. Satsanga means becoming attached to being honest with one another. Literally, if you play out the implications of each of these two words, satsang, that's how we're calling these meetings, right? Satsang, which is show up with the courage of being willing to be honest, seeing for who you are, seeing the other for who they are. And if we both allow that to happen, if we trust enough to allow that to happen, there will be an undeniable experience that, again, will speak volumes and far more than self-centeredness. Actually, self-centeredness is a very small, insignificant situation. Though sometimes it may feel like, wow, such a big illusion and such a complex entanglement. I mean, this thing called self-centeredness. Yeah, that looks like a giant dragon and monster, as long as we do not invoke the presence of something deeper, bigger, more powerful. When you look at the dragon at the face in the context of satsanga, the dragon basically disappears. We lose sight of that because we are being exposed to something more deep. That's what Krishna says in the Gita. Param drishtanivartante, rasobarjam rasopyasya param drishtanivartante. When we are exposed to a higher taste, Krishna will say, the other taste is naturally recede. It's not that even you have to think about that consciously. So I try to make this point over and over again from different places. So we also conceive our practice in positive terms. It's not only how do I get rid of this self-centeredness? Get out, self-centeredness. Get out of here, you ugly witch, whatever. And we develop a negative orientation to our practice, right? It's all about getting rid of the ugly stuff, so to say, or getting rid of illusion, or getting rid of that which is impossible, because again, self-centeredness is actually an impossibility for us. So it's more about expose yourself to positive experiences and narratives that clearly give you an undeniable trailer of what is greater belonging, how it feels to expand the circle of belonging. So self-centeredness is no longer necessary. So you can dispose of that like in a very natural way, no? Like the example, though he was not speaking in these terms, but in the Srimad Bhagavatam, Dhruva Maharaj, right? In the fourth canto, Dhruva Maharaj, he's a bhakta, and at one point long story short, he wanted to have a kingdom, very big kingdom, way bigger and more powerful than the one his own father had, because there was some revengeful spirit because of some mistreatment that his father had perpetrated to him, basically. So he started to worship and pray to Bhagavan for something material, still somehow self-centered, right? Self-centered bhakti. There are degrees of self-centeredness, of course, right? It's not like just there's self-centeredness and love-centeredness. There are endless nuances in between. Sometimes there's false ego, extended false ego. It's all about me, or it's all about what is mine, what I like. So I love my car because it's my car. I love my country, of course, because it's my country. So it's not me, it's the country, but it's important just because it's in relationship to me. So there are varieties of this. And the Bhagavatam agrees, no, there are different ways of bhakti. Almost nobody starts practicing pure bhakti. Most of us start practicing mixed bhakti, and gradually it's getting more and more refined and polished. So Dhruva Maharaja is one of those examples. He prayed for material blessings. I want this kingdom and I want this opulence and I want this and that. I'm motivated by some form of anger and revenge spirit. So, which is not the right, it's not the ideal way to pray to God and practice bhakti. But the Bhagavatam shows that to normalize, well, sometimes we show up from that place also. At least you show up, right? Again, Krishna says in the Gita, Artha Jignasura Artha Tigyani Chavaratarshava. Now, at least you are worshiping me, no? Looking for money, looking for knowledge, for fame, but you're coming to me. And eventually, of course, Dhruva is exposed, following what we're talking, to a greater circle of belonging. He has darshan of Krishna, of Bhagavan, Vishnu in this case, and he realizes, oh, what's this? This is bigger, right? This experience, that experience make him feel so bigger, so deeper, so more fulfilled and wholesome. And even when Bhagavan fulfill all his desire, here is your kingdom, here is your power, here's your everything you wanted. He no longer was thinking about that. He was just thinking about what he experienced when he saw God. And then there are so many prayers where he's really mentioned things like, I thought I was praying for the higher thing, and then realized that was a few pieces of broken glass on the floor, kingdoms and this and that, in the sense of it was all related to me. But now that I realized that the world does not revolve around me, and by seeing you, I can see me belonging in a bigger circle. Oh, that's the higher taste. But again, he needed to have a certain experience to have the aha moment, right? To have the click. And again, there's not only one click. There's not only one aha moment. Therefore, there's not only one experience necessary. We need a succession of them. So hopefully every single day that we pass on in this lifetime provides some of those experiences. So we are advancing into this direction of gradually enlarging our circle of belonging, enlarging, expanding our consciousness basically means that you are enlarging your circle of belonging, your awareness of how much everything truly belongs. And the opposite is a contraction of consciousness, a hyper-localized, sectarian, tribal idea of belonging, or a hyper-suffocating self-isolation, self-centeredness, and there are endless shades of that in between. So, I don't know. That's what came today, Gayatri. I don't know if I understood the question correctly. Maybe I missed it again. You tell me.
Yes, I think you gave a very wonderful vision. That didn't exactly answer to the question, but you mentioned during the answer that it is impossible to meet a shared dynamic of this shift because it's very individual. So I already doubted about this, and so you confirmed this and gave a general shape to the situation anyway.
Okay. I'm glad
Thank
it
you so
helped
much.
somehow. Thank you. Okay, so we'll put a little pause and we'll invite you to the breakout rooms, those who would like and have the chance and time to continue churning these reflections about moving from self-centeredness to a reality of sheer belonging and unconditional love, and what gets in the way, what's in between, where do we find ourselves in that journey, whatever you feel that you need to share. So I will put pause the recording and activate the breakout rooms. Okay, welcome back. Hoping you had a good time together sharing. Hopefully giving each other further appetizer on what it means to be expand the circle of belonging. That's what we are trying to do every single weekend. Before we go to the next question, anything any treasure worthy of being shared publicly that you got from your public private sharing? I forgot to ask that last week, so I'm trying not to make the same mistake again. Or during your personal contemplations, for those of you who couldn't share, if there's anything you may like to share in that regard briefly. Jamona.
Gautrain said, I don't know if I'll be able to repeat it properly, but Gautrain came up with a beautiful point. It was just a lovely one-liner of he was saying in regards to Shulashri Damaraj would say that you need to change your perspective. So instead of looking, having yourself as the center of the circle, that you're on the perimeter of the circle, looking inwards to the Lord, that everything is revolving around him. I just thought that was very beautiful.
Yeah, and as we always say, no, if you're in a circle, we are sitting like the example of give, we are sitting at a circle table. We are all at the same distance from the center, right? So in that sense, we are all in the same proximity. Not so much distance indicates farness rather than nearness. Thank you for sharing. And I'm seeing a few raised hands from the ones who already raised their hand for questions. But before that, if anyone else would like to share anything from the breakout rooms, you can just unmute yourself directly so we don't confuse the raised hands of the questions with the whatever you would like to share.
So maybe I would like to add.
Yes, Gopi
Yeah, can I
Janan.
just as a reflection we had in our small group was also to speak about, so to differentiate, you can belong to someone. It's easier to belong, let's say, to feel like part of a group in a concert, on a soccer game, or what you mentioned, because it's also impersonal. And the moment you belong to a group and you it's personal, the other people are there personal and you are there personal with everything, that is like the makes a big difference.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a price to pay, right? Yeah. It's more challenging. It's more inviting, of course. Yeah. Thank you. Okay, let's move to the next raised hands, respecting the original order. So next comes Carrie from Washington, D.C., I assume. So welcome, Carrie.
Yes. Hi. I think it's actually really nice that my question follows Gayatri's because I think it's kind of connected and it comes from something from a few weeks ago when we were all together in Italy. So my question comes from our experience learning from the nuns who managed the guest house that we stayed at in La Verna. And there were two nuns, for those of you who weren't there. They were part of an order, San Vincenzo de Paoli, that focuses on serving the poor and serving people in need. So one of the nuns told us that she volunteered to support yoga classes that help people with substance abuse problems, and she has done a bunch of volunteer work with orphans. The other nun explained that her personal connections with the Roma community were what led her to want to spend helping people who may be vulnerable or need help. So they explained to us that they do this for anyone, right? Like not based on whether the people receiving the services are Catholic or religiously inclined. They're not really out there trying to convert anyone, but this is their act of devotion, right? They see this as their service. And I really don't hear much focus on this kind of thing in our circles. I mean, we know, of course, that pure devotees are kind to everyone, and that must mean everyone, not just people within the so-called devotee community. But otherwise, for the rest of us who are not pure devotees, trying to find our way in devotional service, I just don't hear a lot about the things we do as part of the broader human community beyond the Gaudiya Vaishnava community as being part of our service. And in fact, it's often kind of downplayed, right? It's characterized as karma yoga or material pious activities or things like that. So I wanted to know, is there a role for treating the things we do outside the so-called devotee community as a devotional practice in a way that's not an afterthought?
You know my answer to that question, Kerry. You've read Radical Personalism. We've talked in Washington, D.C. about this. But I appreciate the question, of course, which gives me a chance of, repeating things that are a thing and they are worthy of being repeated because, as I agree with your question, these things are not emphasized enough. Sometimes, at least in some circles. Again, I don't like to say, like, Gaudiya Vaishnavism is only one thing and everyone emphasizes exactly the same thing, because it's not like that. And it's the same with Christianity or any other group, right? You may go to Christian places, but they're all, I don't know, hermits, and they are not interacting with society at all. No, and they are praying, and that's their service to society, which is very different, in one sense, very different outside, on the outside of how it may look to be there with the poor or with the one in need. And I wouldn't say it's one is better than the other, it's just different ways of serving, as long as the proper understanding is there and nobody's feeling any superiority, inferiority complex. It's for me all a complementary work, teamwork. But I agree, and that's why I remember radical personalism. I dedicated a few sections, especially a chapter on activism. I remember we had part of our conversation with Hari Kirtan Prabhu in my Free Radical podcast was also in connection to involvement in society, which again doesn't need to be for everyone, but there should be a place for that in a way that is not seen as inferior, so to say. Something that I've thought many times in this connection is that, and again, don't take me wrong, I'm not saying this to downplay Christianity and put my tradition above, but I think that in one sense Christianity doesn't have too much of a clear depiction of how eternity looks like. So somehow that makes them concentrate all most of their notions of service in the here on planet Earth to the neighbor, so to say. And not so much, there's not so much emphasis on serving God. Or if there is serving God by serving. And I'm not against that. No, don't get me wrong. Again, I'm just mentioning how I feel that's their conception and their approach, which again is beautiful. Now, in the Gaudiya tradition, there is, I will say, arguably way more details about who God is and what's going on in transcendence. And sometimes the price, as beautiful as that is, and at the end of the day, this is converging into a critique to my own tradition, as beautiful as that is, that may create some form of disconnect from the daily life in the world, and we may become too much exclusively focused on service in transcendence, or internally conceiving I'm serving the divine, or only in the temple, or only in the altar, or only in connection to the guru, or only, no, this and this and this is service, but this and this and this is, as you say, or karma yoga, or who knows what. So still, there's some divide. Again, I'm not saying that's the teaching of the tradition. I'm not saying everyone is in the tradition thinks like that, but overtly, I've seen that. So I always thought, okay, that's a price to pay for having a very detailed depiction of the divine that somehow may create a kind of disconnect with the here and now. And on the other way around, they have a more, in Christianity, a more unclear, if you will, or not too specific depiction of eternity, and that makes them concentrate fully in the here and now. And eternity, in one way, remains a mystery in many ways, but they will feel what I'm experiencing on Earth somehow is a trailer of eternity. So again, I have nothing against that. I'm not here saying one approach is better than the other. I'm all for an integration of both. I mean, I don't think one needs to cancel the other. We can have a beautiful prospect of eternity, how eternity looks like in terms, in ways that, how to say, that I'm trying to point into a direction that I actually feel comfortable staying there forever, so to say. Now, I'm receiving a depiction of God and of the spiritual world, let's say, that is charming enough for me to invest my life into that direction. But again, I will say at the same time, in general, that shouldn't be at the expense of serving in society, basically. And there are different ways to do that. And of course, we can learn from the Christian tradition, but I don't think, again, we should be also be careful, as we were talking many times, of comparing traditions in the sense of generally many times, not always, but many times, sometimes the tendency is And I'm not talking in your case or anyone's case in general. In some cases, it may happen the tendency, the grass is greener on the other side of the fence. So sometimes we tend to appreciate what the other is doing and compare and think, oh, they are doing better than us, which may be true sometimes. And we can learn the lesson and that's great. But sometimes it's not that it's actually true. It may be that they are doing it differently, and it may be a compliment or whatever. I'm talking in general, right? So I'm just mentioning that to be careful of that tendency where everything seems better outside. No, they seem not to be having the problems we have. They seem to be more mystical or more deep or more broad-minded. And then when you actually talk with anyone in depth, you realize, oh, they have the same problems we all have in any group in their own way. But still we can still we can learn. So yeah, everything can be bhakti. I mean, that's one of the main points of radical personalism for me, that Anjiva Goswami makes that point, Sangha Siddha Bhakti. Any activity can be imbued with bhakti. So I don't need to, how to say, to limit myself to this and this and this and this is bhakti, is love, is service, and everything else is entangling me in the karmic network, so to say. If I'm doing with the right conception, and there are so many verses in the scripture speaking about honoring everyone, serving everyone, many activities related to welfare work in society. Of course, at the same time, to be honest, there's this the distinction because you can do all those things, and those things cannot be bhakti, right? You can be a very pious person and be an atheist, and it's fine. I'm not condemning that person. I'm just saying there is a dif this difference between just sattvic pious action and spiritual action. Now, the problem is when we are doing a spiritual action, we may forget that those pious things can be done as part of my spiritual action with the proper orientation. It's not like, oh no, that's not spiritual, that's pious only. I'm creating that divide. But from a proper spiritual perspective, everything belongs, going back to the previous topic. Everything can be part of it. But the other, so you will find all the things. People who are very pious, very engaged in society, but have no spiritual interest to some degree, at least. Some other people who are very much into spirituality, but still in a very dualistic way, creating this divide and still very being a little bit dysfunctional as to how to relate to society. And hopefully a third option, which is people who are genuinely interested in spirituality, and because of that they can understand spirituality doesn't need to exclude any of these other expressions of social welfare, social justice, and this or that, so many forms it can take. So it can all be part of the equation. And yeah, probably we are not talking enough about that yet. We are gaining momentum, and we are trying to normalize some of those themes. And I can understand that for some people that will resonate more than for others. Again, it's fine. There is variety. As long as we do not totally cancel or exclude some of these possibilities, or they do not belong again. And we give ourselves and each other permission to explore their own life and spirituality, how it's aligned with their nature, with their call. And I trust that if we are all sincerely doing that, despite we will not be engaging all of us in the same thing at the same time, which is not possible, we will each other cover the different bases, so to say, hopefully in a complementary way, understanding that all of those are equally valid faces of how bhakti looks like. So I don't know if that somehow serves your exploration, Carrie.
Yes, it did, and it's that third bucket that I think is really interesting, right? So the one where spiritually inclined people are interested in how that connects to what they're doing in society. So yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for your question. And of course, again, we don't need to receive permission from anyone to to do those things that we feel called to do in the context of Bhakti, no? So we shouldn't limit ourselves to until and unless, just to give an example, Swami Padmanabha doesn't tell me officially that I can do that, then I won't do that. Just to give an example how someone may think. It doesn't work that way, right? So I will say that whatever we are sharing now naturally gives permission for each one of us to do our own exploration. Yeah. Thank you, Kerry. Okay, let's go for a moment to another breakout room for a few moments before continuing with the next question. I will put pause to the recording. Okay, welcome back, you all. Wishing you had a spacious gathering and sharing for further reflection, bearing each other witness and accompanying the unfolding of the journey. Is there anything before we move to the next question by Rupa Manjari? Is there anything anyone would like to share that is publicly shareable that you feel it's important, nice to extend to the broader circle of belonging here that you have discovered in your conversations in the breakout rooms, in your personal reflection on this later topic? Silence sometimes is the best answer. No problem. Just doing my part and my homework and trying to be a good boy, inviting you to share your insights. Let's continue with the next raised hand from Rupa Manjari. So you're invited to unmute yourself. Rupa Manjari, welcome.
Okay. Thank you, Maharaj. First of all, I want to thank you for your service for us, to all of us. I mean, you just don't even know how you've changed so many lives. You've given us, your radicalism has given us a whole new way of looking at things, a different angle. It's like you've turned our faces a little bit so we can see things a different way. Unconditional love. Whoever knew that Krishna loved us just the way we are? I mean, incredible.
He knew that all along.
Well, he knew that, but we didn't know it. And our unlimited potential, especially like at this point in my life where I'm getting towards the end point, that I still have all this unlimited potential in this life, let alone the future. I mean, it's just so much hope. The becoming. I mean, it's the whole evolution of love of both for Krishna, of Krishna and us. It's just a really, thank you so much. That's all I can say. But okay, so my question. This is really above my pay rate. I don't really know if I should ask it, but I'm gonna go there anyway. I listened to your talk on Sri Gadadhar and Bhaktivinod Thakur's disappearance day. And even though I'd heard this, some of the things you said there before, it opened up a whole new thing that has I've been worrying about. It was about Bhaktivinod Thakur said that he would like to die at Kurukshetra. He would like to, because that's where Radha was feeling so much separation from Krishna. And it reminded me a little bit of the stigmata thing of wanting to feel Christ's pain. And Bhaktivinoda, of course, he's the Manjari and he's with Radharani all the time anyway, but just that whole thing. And then, but when you said, when you put years on it, when she said, it's been 100 years since she saw Krishna. Krishna, she's waiting for him to come back. And for 100 years, where the gopis are putting cotton under her nose to see if she's still breathing. I mean, and of course, on one hand, Krishna never leaves Vrindavan and he's got his spurtis and all these things that are happening there. But just the idea that on her earthly planet, Krishna left when he was what, 11, 12? And not only that, did he leave her, but then he married all these wives and had children with them. I mean, it's just like unbearable. I mean, I know it's a separation and union thing, but it's one thing when they're in Vrindavan and they just don't see each other overnight and they get union again. But for so long, and that's not just Krishna. Sita Ram, it's the same thing again, the separation. When he banishes her when she's pregnant with his children. And I know that in his case, it's the Dharma king and the ideal and all that. But if this is God and he has it all, He makes his love relationships are so difficult. What is he doing here? I need to reconcile this. I mean, I know that there's a way of looking at it that's going to calm me down a little bit, but I just need to recognize it and so that I could see it more. And I hope that is Radharani married to Abhimanyu in Goloka too? I mean, I can't even imagine. Anyway. Like I said, it's above my pay rate, but
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Rupa Manjari. First of all, of course, for your words of appreciation. It's always humbling. Yeah. And as you say, I think it's a good arrangement that one may not be fully aware of the impact one may have in other people's life. I think it's good that that's the case, because if not, it can get I can you can I can start to take myself too seriously. But at the same time, it's good to be aware enough to be grateful and humbled and committed in that service. And of course, to know that I'm not the absolute doer of anything. I'm just playing my part along with other things in the dance, and we are working together. So thank you for also being a receptacle of whatever we are trying to share. And regarding your question, well, there are a few things there where to start. Of course, first of all, I think it's important that I mean, I appreciate that you start saying this about my pay grade. And I will say probably it is above everyone's pay grade, in the sense that we need to go beyond our self to understand the things properly, in the sense that if we just try to analyze the dynamics of the lila, how the lila function according to what usually makes sense to us on a daily basis, many of the things may not make any sense, or even may they may give an idea that God is a little bit cruel or whatever, even masochist. Why this separation thing? Why this? Why that? Many whys may come if we just filter the lila with our non-lila eyes, so to say. No, so that's why many acharyas have tried to caution us, not so much do not ever read the lila, but be careful not to project, no, and not to try to understand the dynamics of lila, because lila again is not just like a nice story. Lila is the way love moves, right? Lila basically is interaction between Bhagavan and his devotees. Let's put it that way in brief terms. In the context of love, love is the only currency in that market. So lila is all about love. So that's how love moves. And love, for that, we need to understand the nature of love. And as I try to say a few words in Evolution and Divine Love, since you referred to that also in the beginning. And love, in one sense, creates its own necessity, right? Love creates fulfillment, but paradoxically, love creates a need for more. For more love, not for more of something else, because there is nothing else. When you learn to love, you realize there is nothing else beyond this. But inside this, there is no limit to how much love can be loved. So that creates its own thirst, its own paradoxical holy dissatisfaction. And therefore, the dynamics of the lila, which again, it's all about the movement of love, is fueled by this union and separation back and forth. And of course, from the outside lenses, some of these dynamics of separation may seem tragic, may seem extreme, may seem cruel, may seem like too much. But we have to do not forget what's going on the inside, what's going on beyond what we are perceiving. And then you have all these endless statements in Shastra about how what seems like deadly and horrible, it's absolutely filled with bliss. Like Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami, for example, says in Chaitanya Charitamrita, Bahya Biswa Jalahai Bhitari Anandamai, Krishna Premer Adhut Charit. So he's describing, you mentioned Krishna, Radha, and you mentioned Sitaram. And again, we didn't go to Mahaprabhu. But we are speaking about Krishna and Radha, right? Separation, these 100 years of separation. whatever Radha experiences separation from Krishna, and as you gave the example, she's in the 10th. There are 10 stages of separation, and the 10th one is mriti, which means death, which doesn't mean you die, but you feel like dying in separation from your beloved. But you do not die because you know if I die, my beloved will not be happy with that. So somehow or other, I managed to stay alive. Imagine that type of criterion, right? Like I cannot bear continue to live in separation, but somehow or other I will manage to continue living because if not, I will cause pain into the heart of my beloved. No? So again, this is beyond our pay grade, at least beyond mine. We can of course still hear about the things and hopefully be charmed by them. Aspirationally, like feel, oh wow, this is such a so high, so deep, so long term, but at the same time so charming and so noble idea. Such a It makes sense in its own way of making sense. It makes perfect sense. Yes, love must be like that. Perfect love should express like that. So this separation of Radha from Krishna, again, let's not be partial. It's not that Radha is separated from Krishna, she's suffering in separation from Krishna. Krishna is equally suffering in separation from Radha. It's not like, I mean, if you read, I don't know, you mentioned, okay, Krishna went to Dwarka, he got married and had children, so he seems to be having a great, better time that Radha bordering death at every single moment. But you will read in Bhagavatamrita how Krishna is like dreaming about the gopis and crying and calling them and desperately and somehow getting married to these kings, queens in Dwarka because somehow they resemble the gopis and they give him some hint of who the gopis are and all the different things. Of course, all these queens are expansion of the gopis, so let's not forget all these type of interconnections. It's not entirely separate, but both are suffering in separation from each other. At the same time, the suffering is sweet. They are not. We don't worship masochist gods. Their suffering is sweet. It's increasing the love for one another. And for example, we didn't touch on Gaur Lila, but what's Gaur Lila? It's Mahaprabhu. I mean, it's Krishna as Mahaprabhu, being absolutely curious about what's the love that Radha feels for me in separation? The main theme of Gaur Lila is separation, it's not union. Mahaprabhu is experiencing Radha Bhav in separation, how Radha feels in separation from Krishna. So, again, on the outside, it seems like that's pathetic, that's undesirable. Well, not for Krishna. That's absolutely desirable for Krishna to the point that the whole Lila needs to be there to somehow satisfy that necessity, no? Trying to empathize with one another. So for me, this is a beautiful way of expressing love. Like, okay, Radha and Krishna are separated from one another. Radha's dying in separation from Krishna. Krishna's dying in separation from Radha. We have these two poems that Rupa Goswami wrote, Hamsaduta and Udab Sandesh, right? So Hamsaduta is the Swan Messenger, which is a poem in which Radha sends a message to Krishna through a swan. And it's conveyed how Radha is feeling in separation from Krishna. And then Udab Sandesh is a message from Krishna sent to Radha through Udab to convey how Krishna is feeling for Radha. No? So I will say that Rupa Goswami made these two compositions to balance the equation so we understand these two sides of the divine are experiencing separation from one another. And again, even if we feel too partial about, no, but Radha is suffering more. Look, Krishna, he's having such a great time in Dwarka, so to say, which I try to explain he's not in certain ways. Of course, again, it's not that he's not having a great time in the ways we are thinking. He's suffering separation, as you say, at the same time he never leaves Vrindavan. At the same time, there's multidimensional. Krishna never leaves Vrindavan and constantly manifests to the Brajavasis on a daily basis in that union in separation. And that's why many acharyas will say that at one point Krishna, when he was outside of Vrindavan, and I need to use quotation marks, he felt, I don't know if it has any purpose for me to return to Vrindavan because they are so absorbed having sportives of me all day long that they already seen me. So they may not notice my arrival or different criteria. So maybe if I come again, they actually realize that I came, they will be so terrified about the possibility of me leaving again. So many considerations that Krishna Acharyas mentioned, Krishna's having in his mind. And many will conclude that Krishna didn't go during that time, trying to prevent further heartbrokenness to the Vrajavasis. And remember, this is a paradox of being God. I mean, Krishna loves the Vrajavasis, but he has so many devotees outside of the Vrajavasis, and he's trying to fulfill all his duties. So that's what Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami paraphrases Krishna in the fourth chapter of Adi Lila. You know, like Krishna tells to the gopis and Radha, you only worship me. You're exclusive in your dedication to me, but I'm divided because I have so many devotees. So I give myself to all my devotees, to you as well, but to so many others. But in relation to you and me, you are all only focused on me. And again, that's the reason for Gaur Lila, Krishna wanting to pay back somehow the debt of love on top of experiencing what Radha feels for him in separation. Now, as tragic as it may seem to us, those 100 years or whatever, Krishna is absolutely empathic with that, and he feels, I want to experience that so I can also understand better what Radha feels, how I can properly honor that. So at the end of the day, it's not, there's no like whimsical cruelty or any of those things where some heart is insensitive. It's all about the highlight of love, not love becoming higher. Again, Bahya Biswa Jalahoy Bittari Anandamoy Krishna Premer Adbhuta Charit. I didn't translate the verse when I quoted it. Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami said, on the outside, this divine love looks like poison. Dying in separation, cotton put on the nostrils to see if you are still alive, 10th taste of separation, death-like. One may think, I don't want to go there. I don't want to go through any of that. Bahya Biswa Jalahoy Bhitare Anandamoy. But if you look in the inside, it's Anandamoy. It's sheer bliss. It's made of bliss. It's paradoxical bliss. Krishna Premer Adbhuta Charit, says Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami. Those are the Adbhuta Charit, the astonishing features of Krishna Prem, of divine love. They are not to be understood through the usual logic. We understand things because love moves in its own way. Love moves in a crooked way. Love demands its own way of being understood. If we try to apply normal logic to love, that won't work. Atarko apratishtana, we will end up in a form of limbo. So basically, that's idea. It's all about love. It's all about dedication to love. And Radha will never complain. Radha, whatever happens, and this is the main point, at least, that may help us as sadhakas to appreciate all this. whatever is happening in all these instances that we are going through, it's only increasing the love in all sides. No. Krishna is leaving Vrindavan, Krishna is staying in Vrindavan, Krishna is doing this, Krishna is doing that. It's all increasing the love. That's to showcase the nature of true love. No matter what you put in front of it, it can only increase. Which is the exact opposite of conditional love, so to say, which even all the things are given into place for our love to increase sometimes, which is not to go there, so to say. But in the case of the definition of prem that actually Rupa Goswami gives is that thing where you have enough reasons for love not to increase, love still increases. That's real prem. When there are so many obstacles that you could have good excuses to say, well, my love didn't increase because you see all these obstacles that I have. But actually say the nature of prem is that those obstacles become like udipan, becomes like fuel into the fire. And then the real nature of love is, again, no matter what you put in front, it increases the love. Call it, it's union, it's separation. And union and separation are these natural dynamics, like cycles, like seasons, if we want to use a relatable term here, like the different seasons fulfill a role in the whole cycle. So union and separation serve the purpose to make love refresh, go deeper, renew, expand dynamics. A dance, like a dance, right? In a dance, you are not always doing standing in the same step and not moving, right? You cannot call that dance. There have to be movement, and in that moment, if you are dancing with someone, sometimes the partner will get closer, sometimes the partner will get farther, but it's all part of the dance. So those are some perspectives that come to my mind, so maybe it may help, hopefully, to understand some of the things in ways that do not sound like unjust or whatever, right? Do not trigger us to some other patterns. So you tell me, Rupa Manjari, how does it sound?
Jai, well, it sounds good. It's just my mortal eyes still looking at it, right? Looking at it from this my mortal vision as opposed to the bigger one. And Lord Chaitanya, that's really where I should go, I think, is I think I need to dive deeper into Mahaprabhu to so I can get this the union and the searching for it too. So that was a good direction that you when you said that about.
Thank you. Yeah, Gaur Lila is so crucial for us for so many reasons. Again, sometimes devotees understand Gaur Lila very simplistically. They think, oh yeah, Mahaprabhu broke the Maha Mantra, the Yuga Dharma, and that takes you to Krishna Lila. That's it for Gaur Lila. End of the conversation. It's like, no. That's a huge disservice to Gaur Lila. There's so much more to say. So, and that will help us to properly, so to say, take advantage in service of Krishna Lila. At the end of the day, Gaur Lila and Krishna Lila, they're not two separate Lilas. They are two chambers of the same Lila. But for some reason, all of our acharyas have really emphasized Gaur Lila, and maybe we still need to discover why they have emphasized Gaur Lila so much, beyond what I think it's the reason for the emphasis. And how Mahaprabhu is, what is he exploring, why is he exploring that? What to speak of the role of Gadadhar, the Radha's Gadadhar in Gaur Lila, and the identification with serving the need of the moment, as we talked in this little video I made the other day about his disappearance day. So anyhow, lots to reflect about. Yeah, thank you so much, Rupa Manjari. Okay, I'll skip one breakout room as usually I do that, and we have one more question exploration theme by Gopi Janani from Germany. So I don't know if you're in Germany, maybe you're in Assisi now. Wherever you are, we will know in a minute. So welcome. You can unmute yourself.
Oh, I already started. We're gonna go in the breakout rooms first.
No, you can start. I'm skipping the breakout room. Sometimes I skip a few so it doesn't get too long. Yeah.
Okay, right. Thank you. Well, in La Verna, you mentioned that we come from a very feminine spiritual tradition, and I have been like contemplating on that. What does that mean, or what did you mean on the different levels? And actually, also, what is a masculine spiritual tradition? And I've been thinking, is it actually could it be said that all religions that are basically like looking at the more rules and the outside, could that be called more masculine? And the more you go into the core, the more you focus on bhakti and love, you would call it more feminine? Or is that a gross misunderstanding or misinterpretation? And so I would like to know that. And also, if you speak of this kind of what you have in mind when you speak of that feminine spiritual tradition, What would be a good other example in a different spiritual religion that has a little bit that you could compare, if I may say so?
Okay, thank you. So, yeah, that's another important question and another important theme as we were talking before about certain things that are not emphasized enough, not only in our tradition, but in spirituality in general, is the feminine, which I'm happy that in the recent years this is becoming more normalized than previous decades or centuries, where many times, not only spirituality, but society and politics and so many things were very much masculine oriented, masculine centered in ways that were, again, toxic, because when it becomes just one side of the coin, you lose the nuance, you lose the integration of complexity. Everything is about proper balance of polarities, right? Radha and Krishna is that, not to reduce them to an archetype, but in one sense, Radha and Krishna are divine masculine, divine feminine, and we have those two dimensions in us as well, feminine and masculine. So we have to properly dance with them. That's a beginning, at least, way to honor, to serve Radha and Krishna. No, it's not the same as say, okay, you are in the Leela and this identity is serving the divine couple. But a good way to start to do that from a realistic place as a sadhaka is, okay, how do I integrate my feminine and masculine dimensions? So I agree that feminine dimension is many times not so explored. It's feared, actually. Because again, feminine is like femininity is represents the womb, represents the source of creation, represents creativity. And for creativity to happen, there has to be some form of chaos as well, some form of unknown from which something emerges. So the feminine is very at home with all that if it's properly integrated. And the masculine needs to expose itself to that dimension, because if not, becomes too rigid, too suffocating. Now, as you mentioned, and I agree, a spirituality that is too much emphasizing rules and regulations, and order and structure, it's too much. Too masculine, so to say. Again, I have nothing against masculine. I have nothing against feminine. No, we don't want to create a battle of genders, so to say, because again, we are talking about dimensions that need to be integrated on proper balance. So yeah, that's how it looks in a spiritual tradition or group. Those who are not so much working on the feminine side, there will be too much leaning toward absolutism, too much certainty, no fixed answers, everything predictable, everything in boxes, all the perfect answers to everything, no place for uncertainty, no need for that, no need for doubt. We have the perfect things. It's like this, like this, like that. That's it. There's no need to think in terms of development and unfolding and expansion. It's what it is, and you take it, and that's a magical formula done. So at the end of the day, that can become too suffocating. That can become, not, I won't go into, of course, details and names and examples, because I don't think I need, because I think we all have been exposed to that, both in Gaudiya tradition or other traditions, but that's still going on in many places, right? Like rigidity, tribalism, fundamentalism, sectarian spirit, like some of the posts I shared, I think yesterday, from Bhaktivinoda Thakur, like the sectarian mentality, or you dress differently, you use a different mark in your body, you are singing in this language, and you are compartmentalizing reality and putting everything into tidy boxes. That's masculine. Too much. Not healthy masculine. dysfunctional one that needs to control too much. So that ends up becoming, that's how you end up having a totalitarian regime, a dictatorship. I don't know, a Holocaust. That was an excess of masculine energy. Now, too much control, too much wanting to control how everything looks, a particular race, a particular purity in people, and this has to be eliminated so we keep the proper things in place. It's an overdose, so to say, of toxic masculinity, but it takes that form, like excessive certainty and control. It becomes suffocating, of course. I'm not saying that we don't need some of that. Of course we need, we do. We need some structure, some order. No, I mean, I wake up in my day generally, we need some order. We need to have some certain idea how they may unfold, knowing that so many things will happen that were not in our control, but sheer chaos may be equally bewildering. No? So an excess of feminine content, so to say, where everything is unknown and mystery, it may be too much. Right, so we want a balance of both. That's for me how spirit speaking in terms of spirituality, how healthy spirituality looks. I'm reminded of a particular way of how Father Richard Rohr will speak, and he will use these two figures from the Christian tradition, but we can all relate to that in one way or another with our particular tradition. He will speak about the priest and the prophet. So the priest is more the one who is keeping the order, no? Keeping the order, the place, the rules, the things how to be. No? Someone needs to do that because there's always people who need that type of discourse, who need like a formulaic approach, like this is like this is like that, no need to think more than that. This is it, this is the box, this is the formula. And the prophets are the one who will disrupt the order that the priests are taking care of. But ideally, the priests and the prophets are not enemies of one another. That's another important point, because if sometimes that's the real problem. The real problem is not that there are only priests or only prophets, is that the priests many times feel threatened by the prophets, or that prophets, they do not understand the need for priests. I mean, the need for order. No, that's my point. Whether you call it priest or prophet, right? Because sometimes, in the name of disrupting the order and bringing newness, you can also go to an extreme of anarchy or disruption, and you can end up confusing people, hurting faith. I don't know, many things that can create unnecessary, avoidable, can create avoidable chaos. So, but in the name of disrupting the order, you're like, ah. We have seen that many times, people being dissatisfied with a certain, even socially speaking. Okay, I do not agree with certain things, how they're going socially. So that I bring a disruption to that, but in a way that creates a new problem rather than creates healing, that creates integration. So I think, again, it's important to have all those things. People in any community preserving certain structures and ideas, and tending to the needs of, for example, a newcomer who will need something more simple, something more formulaic, some more black and white notions in the beginning. If you become too nuanced, it's like, no, imagine if you try to explain to your 3-year-old boy something in super nuanced way. The boy will look at you like, what are you talking about? Why are you so complicated? No, making it more simple, please. So then you give some black and white, it's like, oh, thank you, that's great. And the boy is in ecstasies, and you as an adult are like, that's totally dissatisfying, that explanation. But that person needed that. So it's important to acknowledge there is a genuine place for higher degree of order and structure, but at the same time, we do not end up worshiping that box. We understand its purpose, but also we need to understand when it's when one has outgrown that chapter and something new needs to be brought to the table. So I think, like a priest, again, going back to the priest prophet analogy, a priest Okay, maybe his service or a guru. We can say a guru or a Brahmin or a temple president. Use the word you want. It doesn't matter. But there are peoples in charge of order and structure and institution and managerial stuff, and they need to keep the thing working together. And again, it's okay. But I think as long as they don't lose sight that at one point there is the need for a profit, there is a need for disruption, there is a need for new thinking, there is a need for things collapsing to be born again, there is a need for crisis. So as long as they know that all those things are also necessary and welcome, there's no problem to them keeping order and structure. When they lose sight of that, then as they start worshiping the order and the structure as the deity itself, and then you have a form of idolatry, basically. And that becomes more and more narrow-minded and suffocated, and you end up with a cult. And again, in the same way, prophets, those prophets should be trained. Now, Father Richard Rohr said we should have a ministry of prophets. Now, like, people are trained to become proper disruptors, like to disrupt order for the right reasons. Again, not for the sake of disruption itself, but as a service. Now, a disruption doesn't mean burn a temple or this enter a class and start to shout, but just bring certain conversations and bring certain nuance and ask certain questions and empower people to think for themselves and give permission to people to explore what they have been forbidden to explore when they are ready to explore those things or whatever. Whatever things that may be seen for others as controversial, as dangerous, or threatening, but actually there may be necessary for many. So, and that's the paradox, which is that there will be no point where everyone will be at the same stage. So everyone will be, there will be no point where everyone will be okay with prophets or everyone will be okay with priests. Now, there will be always some people needing one thing and some other people needing another thing. And that will create some unavoidable tension. Bhaktivinoda Thakur speaks about that. That's the perennial tension between Kanishthas and Madhyams, he will say. Without criticizing anyone, he's just saying a Kanishtha needs a more simplistic black and white conception. But he cannot understand the Madhyam, who is doing things in a different way, needs to be more broad and more nuanced. And they will think, oh, this Madhyam is like diluting the whole thing, watering down or confused or whatever. He's not loyal enough or chaste enough. He's not strict enough. And the Madhyam, hopefully, if the person is genuinely Madhyam, will understand. Unlike the Kanishtha, who cannot understand the Madhyam, because of being a Madhyam, will understand, oh, the Kanishtha is thinking in that way because he's there. I've been there, so I know how it feels. But I cannot expect that person to understand where I am because that person hasn't got there yet. So there will be some unavoidable friction there, some unavoidable tension, which is unavoidable, but hopefully we can navigate that without that being creating any bigger conflict, so to say. So that's the art of community and communication and empathy and learning to understand each other, even if we cannot understand each other. At least hopefully, I don't know if the ideal scenario will be if a Kanishtha thinking, oh, that Madhyam is so broad and nuanced, not so loyal, chaste. At least that's Kanishtha hopefully has a guru or a guide who is more advanced and said, you know what? I understand that you cannot understand that person and you don't need to understand that person, but that person is not deviant. He's not doing wrong. It's just in a chapter that now is not your moment to understand. Eventually you will understand. Don't pay attention in that direction. Now you will get disturbed. At least someone, the ideal scenario will be that. So the Kanishtha do not continue like thinking, criticizing that person. Sometimes that happens, sometimes that doesn't happen. So, and we find that in all traditions. So I think going back to the feminine masculine dichotomy, femininity brings more spontaneity, more connection with experience, with more openness to discovery and mystery and being okay with the unknown, more emphasis on creativity, on connection with one's emotions and embodiment. So I think all that is very necessary to balance a toxic masculinity that can get up too much entangled from the neck up, overthinking certain things and disconnecting from what's happening from the neck down, so to say, from certain rigidity. So at least those who are leaders of any religious community, I will say, should be properly trained or prepared to have these parts in them integrated at least to some healthy degree. Even if the ones who are following them are not yet there, at least they are there and they can gradually accompany the others to gradually get there, to see the value in a proper integration of these polarities. So I don't know if I'm missing something that you would like to explore, Gopi Janani, if that's helping.
Well, no, I thought that was a very nice and broad explanation of also the two parts, how to integrate them. What is still open, but you don't need to, I mean, I'm aware of time. Also, this question of this outer religion and more the mystical traditions inside. And if you have similar system traditions that can be explored for us that have a similar approach.
The audio was cut at times, so I'm not sure if I fully understood the question. You were asking me about religions which had their mystical side.
Yes, so my because my impression is that all religions, when we talk about, even when we talk about Christianity and so we always have this framework, the bigger religious structure and institution, and then you have the mystics that are the spiritual revolutionaries. And I wonder if this and I think there all the mystics and all the different traditions meet. There is the core, where it's the same or where it's being met. And my question was, if you had another, even in the in Islam or so, a similar approach also to this feminine side, what you meant.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I'll respond briefly because of time consideration. But yes, of course, there's, as you properly said, we have all these main traditions like Christianity, Islam, Judaism, Hinduism, to use a very generic, broad term, and so on. And in everyone, you find this like more institutional religious structure and majority of practitioners doing that more from a social religious perspective. And then you have the mystics. No? So in Islam, you have the Sufis. In Judaism, you have the followers of the Kabbalah. In Christianity, you have so many Christian mystics, and the same in our tradition and other Indic traditions, Sanatan Dharma traditions. Again, you will find those who are just practicing their religion for money and home and fortune in this world, and others who are really interested in having an actual experience, right, of the relationship with the divine. And yeah, I will, in my conversations and in my study of how these mystics of the sister traditions converge, not converge absolutely, because of course there are different orientations and conceptions of the divine and so on, but converge at least enough to be all can be considered mystics. I will say that all of them will be exhibiting this feminine approach. Again, not to say that there's no masculine element in that, but there's a marked feminine approach that it's crucial to make a mystic, so to say. So you will find that in the lives and practice of all of these great personalities across traditions. And I've had in my personal experience of sharing with people from those traditions, yeah, you can feel that they are healthy people that are at least trying to integrate properly these dimensions. And that's what ultimately makes them mystics. Ideally, a mystic, I will say, someone who is wholesome as well. Again, Though I know that the conversation can be nuanced, and some people can say a mystic is someone, can be someone spiritually advanced, vertically advanced, but horizontally may not be properly integrated. But I will try, at least my preferred conception of a mystic is someone who is not only holy, but whole at the same time. No? So there's holiness and there's wholeness. So part of the wholeness is the proper integration of the feminine and masculine dimension. So, yeah, as much as I can say with the time you have, sorry, but thank you for the question. And before we conclude, still, I'd like to invite you to one more breakout room before we put our session to rest today. So I will be opening the rooms now, inviting you for a few minutes, and they will be back for our final goodbye of the day. Okay, welcome back again. Hoping you had a good time. With that, we'll put our sharing to rest today. Hoping you had a nourishing time. Grateful for that, for your presence, for your questions, and looking forward to meeting you soon. I will be confirming during the week, but I'm not so sure if I will be able to be next Saturday because we'll be having a intense retreat in Ananda Dam. Over there, we'll be having many lectures, and of course, the idea is to record them and share them. And probably Saturday evening, it may be not possible. So I will let you know. But if not, again, part of love is the dynamics of separation, union and separation. But we'll be letting you know. Meanwhile, may you have a blessed closing of the week, beginning of the next one. Sriman Mahaprabhu Ki Jai, Sri Harinam Prabhu Ki Jai.
Hi.
Gaur Bhaktavrinda Ki Jai, Gaur Premanand Hari Bol.
Hare Bol.